time once again for Community Forum. And we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Hex. Hex is with the IWW and GDC and was the activist who was shot and severely injured back on January 20th of this year in Red Square at the University of Washington campus. Hex, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me in.
So start out. Tell us about a little bit about yourself and how you ended up being on campus at the very well-publicized demonstration.
Yeah, that's a bit of an interesting story. So I'm going to start out a little bit with, I'd known about Milo coming to speak for a little while, had kind of been like trying to oppose that. My partner and I had both been like, you know, posting things on Facebook and just, you know, little things like that. And I had planned on kind of going to an action there. I hoped that somebody else would call for an action to oppose this guy. Nothing was really kind of coming together. We actually ended up going on vacation, so I wasn't really involved in any of the in really much of the organization that was happening to kind of oppose him on campus. At the same time, this is on January 20th, so this is Inauguration Day. There are all these huge marches against Trump, right? I didn't really feel like it was appropriate to oppose, you know, authoritarianism, racist authoritarianism, to oppose fascism by marching around away from a place where, you know, a fascist was speaking, right? Like you confront them on their territory, in their space. And that's really how to deal with it from my perspective. So I, you know, we got home the Friday or Saturday, I think, or sorry, Friday before the event. Or Thursday before the event, day before the event. I'm a little bit unclear on right now. But yeah, so the day before the event, and, you know, the next day I kind of like went down early on to kind of like see what was happening. There was a walkout that day, so I kind of wanted to talk to some of the students. I ended up just going there. I was kind of there more or less just to kind of observe the situation. I wanted to see what was happening. There had been some discussion about neo-Nazis that the Milo speech would be a rallying point for neo-Nazis, and so I wanted to try and keep an eye out for any of those folks. And we did see some people who, you know, fit that description pretty well. Like I said, I wasn't really masked up or anything. I wasn't really hiding my identity. There was a general call out that said to mask up, to hide your identity, because, you know, Milo and his sort of circus of oppression tries to like find people who are unmasked and take pictures of them with their whole kind of shock cam, whatever, I don't remember the name of the term for it, but yeah, so they kind of would go around and target people, leftist activists who were trying to oppose them, and terrorize them. They were trying to incite fear. They try to incite fear in people who show their faces, basically, and show their faces in opposition to Milo. So I wasn't doing that. It was sort of my choice. I agree with people who did cover their faces. I think that was a really good idea. So I was kind of observing. I wasn't really intending on ever actually getting into the mess of protesters or anything like that. I was going to kind of stay on the sidelines, you know. And then I saw some fights breaking out and things like that, and I walked in to kind of intervene. There are other things that were happening. I can't really talk about a lot of details specific to, you know, right around the time of the shooting. But, you know, I came in, you know, related to scuffles and things like that. And I ended up getting shot. And that's basically the story of that. And there's some really interesting stuff. Like, there are some things that I'd never experienced, and I a lot of people just never will experience after being shot, right? Like, there's the experience of, like, you know, me lying on the ground, like, wondering if I'm going to survive, you know, wondering for a while, I was wondering whether I was going to bleed to death, or, you know, if the bullet had gone through my lungs, I was going to drown in my own blood or something like that. That's pretty intense. And I had wondered, you know, I wanted to make sure that, that I could tell my partner, like, one more time, that I love them. So I told, I asked the police who were holding the wound to relay the message. They didn't, as it turns out. but, you know, that's a really intense thing, and it's something that, you know, I think we can touch on a little bit later. I think we should come back to that. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
No problem.
But yeah, I was basically there to oppose authoritarianism, oppose fascism, oppose a viewpoint, and not just opposing Milo, but opposing specifically the individuals who support him, and trying to talk to them. I ended up in conversations with a few of them. In these conversations, I was really just wanting to understand where they're coming from, because I can't really imagine a place where some of the things that they do and some of the things they say are acceptable, you know, for humans to do to each other. I kind of want to understand.
So, and then afterwards, you woke up in the hospital, mm-hmm. I would assume, and probably having to deal with both the pain and confusion as to what the heck happened.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, like, waking up, so that actually brings up another interesting thing, right? Like, so for me, it was just like, you know, I was lying on the ground. People were telling me that I was fine. I was really, really wondering whether that was true. You know, I was going to make it out and everything was going to be okay. I was struggling to maintain consciousness and make sure that, cause like if I can maintain consciousness, I'm not going to be dead. Right. Like, and so I, you know, did that, figured I was probably fine. I finally, as soon as I got into the ambulance, you know, I was like, I know I'm probably going to survive at this point. I asked them to, like, put me to sleep or something like that. They offered, I don't remember. There's a pretty blurry. And they're like, yeah, cool. We can do that. And I'm like, yes, yay. And so, like, that was my experience. It was like, I went from, like, I'm severely injured in this hospital and really uncomfortable and, like, struggling to breathe, to I wake up and I'm on huge amounts of drugs and, like, you know, everything's kind of blurry and I'm, you know, super out of it. But I'm not in a huge amount of pain anymore, and I'm not afraid I'm going to die, right? And so, like, I went. That was my experience, right? That wasn't, you know, that's just my story. And the thing, like, the thing that happens a lot with these kinds of stories is that there are other stories, and those other stories often just completely get erased. And the other story is, like, my partner's story, who waited, for them, like, they waited like 9 hours to find out if I was alive or dead. And, you know, we had some friends who were able to kind of, like, figure out which hospital that I went to and relate that. My parents got to find out. We had, before that, decided, we talked about getting married and for the legal aspects of things, and we weren't really sure because, like, we don't necessarily believe in some of the state institutions or some of the religious aspects of that. And there's some other reasons I won't go into that we have some problems with the concept of marriage. But, you know, we'd gone back and forth about it and decided we probably wanted to get married. And then at that point, it became very, very clear why. and that was it. And we ended up getting married in the hospital, actually. That was really nice. And that made me really, really happy. Makes me really, really happy. But yeah, you know, their experience that, like I said, usually gets erased is sitting there, you know, wondering if I'm alive or dead, having no information and, you know, just wanting to be able to say goodbye, you know, and not being able to, right? Not being able to know whether they do get to say goodbye. And so there's, you know, specifically, you know, I kind of would want to say just right now, if anybody like knows the shooter, there's sort of the people who've been identified by the press and by the police, the couple, right? And between the two of them, I would expect one of them to understand at least, you know, what it means to not know if you're going to get to tell your partner that you love them. Or not knowing if you're going to get to say goodbye. And so if anybody knows them, you know, maybe relate that little bit of information, because I'd like to talk about that. So post-hospital, so we went through, you know, I spent a month in the hospital. So I was, was pretty severely injured, actually. There was no exit wound, so I was carrying the bullet around the whole time for a little while. I believe it was a 9mm. I'm not entirely 100% sure. We pulled it out the other day in the emergency room. So the bullet kind of came in, hit my colon, my gallbladder, destroyed my gallbladder, my liver, poked a hole in my diaphragm. So it was extreme. That was, you know, part of the hole. I was having a huge amount of trouble breathing because I had a big hole in my diaphragm. And they've since, like, they sewed up the hole in the diaphragm. Liver's not too big of a deal. You know, those things grow back, right? my gallbladder's gone forever, which is, I guess, I've been told not that big of a deal. So I guess we'll see. I was really, really afraid what would happen, you know, with a bullet poking a hole in my intestines. That tends to turn out very poorly for most folks. I feel like I'm lucky, you know, to not, you know, be living with a colostomy bag or something like that, you know. Say lucky when I got shot. But anyway, so I will also, you know, for as long as I possibly can, use the joke that, you know, they took out a portion of my colon and sewed it back together, so I now have a semicolon. And I will continue to use that joke as long as I can get away with it. Because I have the right to, basically, I figure at this point. Yeah.
You've been, from the actions at night where, I got the impression from the news media that you were, trying to de-escalate things. And, even though you, were definitely opposed to, the Milo being there.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, first reports were that you had sympathy for the person who had shot you.
Compassion.
And that you're seeking restorative justice for this. I'm wondering if you can touch on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing is, like, I'm, you know, that kind of idea has gone out. There's a lot of different ways that people can interpret that. I want to make it clear that it's not, you know, I want to make it clear that I'm a human being. Right, I'm not some wonderful saintly person. Like, I definitely thought a lot about, like, you know, how much I'm angry about what somebody intentionally did to me. Somebody or whatever, a group of people, whatever. And, you know, there's a person who tried to take my life. When you pull a gun, and I'm actually a in support of gun rights. I'm actually very strongly in support of gun rights, which is kind of a weird place where we, the shooter and I actually have a very strong intersection in terms of beliefs on that point. I don't know about any others. I'm a very strong believer in the right to bear arms. And one of the things that I think about in around that is like, what does it mean? What does it mean to pull a gun? And what it means when you pull a gun, what I've been taught by everyone who has a good understanding of firearms, what it means to pull a gun is that you're going to pretty much kill somebody. If you pull a gun, you're going to destroy anything that it is pointed at. Those are the rules, right? And potentially destroy anything behind it, right? So when you do that, you are making a decision to, if you pull a gun and point it at an individual, you're making a decision to kill that person. You are intending to kill that person. If you have not killed that person, you've basically failed. That's really, really frightening and uncomfortable to me. And I don't think that that's something that I could ever take on, which is why I don't carry. I support the right of other people to carry. And I've talked to people, I'm not saying that this is some impossible thing that nobody is ever responsible enough to carry a firearm. I've talked to people who are ex-military. I've talked to people who are my friends who've thought through some of these things, and I think that there are people who are capable of responsibly carrying a firearm, but they have to really, really think through what it means. And what it means is exactly, the thing we were talking about at the beginning. It means that somebody doesn't get to say goodbye. And it means that somebody doesn't get to say, I love you, or somebody doesn't get to close, to tie up all these loose ends that they have in their lives. And, for me, as I was lying on the ground, I kind of was going through all the things that I would, that would never happen because, I wouldn't exist anymore. And I thought about all my friends and figured, they're going to be able to pick up a lot of it. But the one thing was telling my partner, I love you, and if you can't accept that when you pull that gun, you cut off the ability of an individual to tie up those loose ends and the ability of all the individuals associated with them to tie up the loose ends they have with that individual, right? If you can't accept that, you don't carry a gun. That's the burden you bear. And if you can't accept that, you might kill the wrong person. You may have to live with that for the rest of your life. You don't carry a gun. You're not responsible enough to do that. You're not capable of taking on that risk. I know I'm not able to do that, and that's why I don't carry. I think that there are people who can carry that burden, thought that through, and I respect them and appreciate them. And, it's not me. And obviously it's not the person who shot me, because they fired into a crowd. They fired into a crowd. They fired at me. They intended on killing someone, and they probably would have killed somebody, if it hadn't been me. They would have killed somebody, probably younger than me. And that means somebody with more loose ends. That means somebody who has more, more potential. They could have been they could have done more with their lives, right? And that's completely cut off, And so that's the thing I was thinking a lot about in the hospital. But I think that it's really important to also realize that when you put somebody in prison, you're doing something similar, right? The whole concept of the punishment-based justice, right, is really an Iron Age concept, right? It's not a modern concept. It's not based in science. It's not based in like the way that we think about the world today, now. It's negative reinforcement, and negative reinforcement doesn't work. But not only is it negative reinforcement, like this individual, the individuals identified by the police and by the media are, late 20s, right? Prison potentially ruins the rest of their lives. Either they end up for the rest of their lives in prison, right? Or they end up with this, mark that's on their, on every job application and, you know, whatever, that that basically can make it impossible to get a job, right? And so you know, we're talking about potentially ruining the lives of people who, you know, honestly are human beings, and human beings make really stupid mistakes that deeply affect the lives of lots of people. And I think that that's part of what this is. This is a really, really stupid mistake. And I know I've done really stupid things. I feel like I've grown out of that a lot. But I have to be compassionate. I have to understand that other people apparently, you know, haven't. And if they're willing to have a conversation, I would like to do that. I'd like to understand what they were thinking, where this came from. And I'd like them to understand why what they did was wrong. Because punishment-based justice doesn't... Justice. Punishment-based, quote-unquote, justice, right? Doesn't teach people what they did wrong. You know, think about any time you've been punished for something, especially when you were a little kid, right? Like, what did that teach you? Didn't teach you to not do whatever it was, you know, not steal from the cookie jar, whatever it is, right? Teach you not to get caught stealing from the cookie jar or whatever, you know, right? And that's all it's going to teach them, is like, you know, and that's it, right? Like, what we saw was, you know, I get shot, and then somebody goes and says, oh, it was self-defense, right? That's what I did isn't wrong. I'm just trying not to get caught, right? Rather than accepting, like, this is really, you know, there's no way in which what happened is okay. And if they're just willing to accept that and face that, I think we can talk through things. And that may take a really long time. But I think we can come to agreements about what the right thing to do is in this case. And some of this came from other inspiration. Like I kind of follow the blog of, follow the Twitter of, or was following the Twitter of Block the Bunker, and some stuff about No New Youth Jail. And like in some of the city council meetings, they, you know, some of those folks have, you know, called for alternatives to police. For me, police and prisons and things like that. And that really resonates with my perspectives on things. Obviously, I come from a very different perspective, you know, for some of those folks talking about not wanting a new jail or wanting to use something other than prisons. You know, they're coming at that from the perspective of, like, you know, people being actively, you know, harmed in their communities and stuff like that. For me, this is just not what I believe in, and I don't think it's efficient, right? So we have very different perspectives on why. But very, very, are very, very aligned on sort of the what.
So only a few minutes left. And we had spoken earlier in the week on the phone, and one of the things you had mentioned was what happened to you is what happens to a lot of people of color with regularity.
Yeah.
And as well, in just a few minutes, touching on that it's been a major group effort to help you pull through.
it's a little bit hard for me to be able to touch on both of those things. I think I'm just going to briefly touch on that first. I want to actually briefly just kind of, you know, go back a little bit and talk about, you know, like I said, my partner, you know, was not only there, you know, waiting for me when I got shot, but also has taken care of me and, you know, has taken care of me in a major way. And also my mother-in-law has taken care of me in a really incredible and amazing way. And I think that, like, just in general, if anybody, I want to make people think about the massive, massive amounts of invisible labor that, you know, these two people have had, have been carrying out in my life to support me. You know, and also, you know, I've had a lot of support from lots of friends. People have written letters from, you know, Oakland, New York. One fellow worker from Idaho wrote a letter and, you know, hey, how's it going? And, you know, we've had our whole group of friends kind of like, you know, caring for me, coming into the hospital. There's this huge network. I think it's, you know, it's like, you know, this one individual, I get shot, and then there's this cascading effect. You know, I think this is kind of an interesting thing. Like, conservatives talk about fiscal responsibility and carrying firearms, and then this guy shoots me, right? And what happens? There's a, you know, $400-something you know, medical bill. There's all of the people that you know, or $400,000. Sorry, yeah, the price of a, you know, house in what, Kent or something, you know, whatever, a very, very small house in Seattle. and so there's, you know, and so there's all of those nurses, all of those doctors, all of these, like, this huge effort. And then there's all of, you know, all of my friends, all of, like, these people coming in, bringing me food, doing all of these things. Right. And the one thing that I thought about a lot that whole time is, what if it wasn't me? You know, I'm kind of not the type of person who gets shot. And the, you know, this is a thing I guess we'll have to, you know, let people think about a little bit. Like, what does that mean? The very phrase, I'm not the type of person who gets shot, betrays a lot of really huge problems in society, right? That there is a type of person who gets shot is a problem. It's a problem that, like, I don't believe a just society can stand, you know, that if we know this thing exists, that there is a type of person who gets shot, that we should be doing something about it. And so that's a thing I thought about a lot. And the type of person who gets shot is the type of person who can't afford to pay these huge medical bills and can't, you know, doesn't have the support network that I've had. And that's a major thing. I think that's something that's really important.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. Perhaps we can have you come back on at some point in time and talk about the IWW.
Yeah, excellent. That sounds great.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.